On the night of September 11, 2001, I was woken up by a phone call telling me to switch on the TV. My wife and I watched the clouds of smoke streaming out of the towers and wondered what on earth the people inside were going through. Janelle Guzman McMillan was one of those people. She was on the 64th floor of the North Tower, getting started on her workday, when the first plane hit the building above her floor. If it was hard to fathom the scale of the attack from the outside, it was much harder to figure out exactly what had happened from inside the tower. And Janelle almost got out. Then the skyscraper fell on top of her and her co-workers. Janelle awoke pinned down in a pocket of the rubble, and she endured a strange and painful ordeal in complete darkness for 27 hours. In her last hour, she says, she received comfort from a stranger called Paul, who she never found again, and then she was rescued. Janelle Guzman McMillan was the last survivor pulled from the wreckage of the Twin Towers. Nearly 13 years later, she's a very different person. She told her story in her book that was called Angel in the Rubble. Janelle, welcome to Conversations.
Hello, Richard.
Do you remember what that morning was like when you woke up that day before you went into work?
I remember that morning, the mood was really right. I was feeling really good. And I was about to go into the office to finalize a vacation with my coworker to Miami. And I remember riding the train, going up to the 64th floor of the World Trade Center. That's the first building that got hit. Rushing to my desk. It was actually about 8:05. Got there a little 5 minutes late. But I ran back down to the 44th floor to grab my bagel and cream cheese and head back up to the 64th floor. And I was sitting, setting up my computer. And
you were talking with some friends, too, for a while, weren't you?
Yeah. Suzanne came over, and we were chit-chatting. I was sitting, and she was standing.
Now, you start work pretty early in the day, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
And that's what it's really all about, in a sense,
yeah,
isn't it?
We were just chit-chatting about Monday, which because September 11 was a Tuesday, so we were just having conversation about certain things at the office.
And it was a beautiful blue sky outside. I remember that, too, this peerless, beautiful... beautiful autumn day.
It was a beautiful spring day, I believe. And, you know, I had on my mini skirt, my nice top, a nice pair of high heel shoes. And I was just looking forward to that day, you know.
Now, back then, those days, you were a bit of a fashion plate, weren't you? You liked your nice clothes then,
oh,
didn't you?
Oh, yes. I love dressing up. I just love it too.
You're beautifully dressed today as well.
Thank you. I just love the glitz and glamour. And
what was your job in the World Trade Center?
I was working as an office assistant for the Port Authority. I came through a temp agency, so I was directly under the Port Authority.
Now you're from Trinidad originally.
Originally, yeah. Born and raised in Trinidad.
What brought you to the United States?
I wanted to fulfill my dream of becoming a dancer and a singer and an actress and all of the, you know, the nightlife, the spotlight. I just wanted to be there. And I think that New York would be the best place for me to accomplish that. Trinidad was pretty laid back, and you could only go this so much far in there. And I had been taking part of competition in dance, and I was really good at it. So I said, you know what, I think New York is a better place for me to do this.
Now, your upbringing was kind of quite conservative and quite religious,
Oh, yes. My mom was a full-grown Catholic, outgoing church person, you know, would believe in the power of prayer, believe in God. And she tried to instill that in me. She would take me to church. I actually had made First Communion, being baptized in a Catholic church. And she would really grill me, you know, in doing the right things and reading my Bible, saying my prayer, everything she would taught me. And, you know, and I just totally rejected that. I thought it was so confined.
Well, yeah, because Trinidad's a fun place, isn't it? I mean, there's a lot of singing and dancing that goes on in Trinidad.
Yeah, there is a lot of singing and dancing, but my type of dancing that I wanted to perform was not what Trinidad wanted. So I was just fascinated looking at the MTV movies and just wanted to be next Paula Abdul, next Janet Jackson. And that was part of my dream.
It meant you had to leave a daughter behind, Kimberly. How old was Kimberly at that stage?
Kimberly was 12 when I came to the U.S., and I left Kimberly when actually she was like 6 years old. And, you know, it was hard for me, but I think I was very selfish in that aspect. But I just thought I wanted to make a better life, not only for myself, but for her as well. And I thought, you know, she would be doing really great if she had come to the U.S. with me. But I had to fight to get here on my own first, then sent for Kimberly.
So the plan was for her to join you at some stage.
Definitely.
Working, I went up the World Trade Center in the 1980s. I remember going up to the Windows of the World. Was that the restaurant on the top there?
Unfortunately, I never made it to the Windows of the World.
I went up there. I didn't eat there. Couldn't afford that.
Yes.
I just went there for the view. And the view is really dizzying. Was it dizzying for you to work that high up in the air every day?
Oh, no. It was really fascinating to me. I you know, for the time I got to the United States and I knew of the World Trade Center, I was like, oh, my gosh, you know, that's so awesome to work in that glass building, you know, to be in there. And being on those high floors, it never fazed me no other way. I just thought it was always safe and nothing could happen, you know. And I just believed that the engineer who designed it, it has to be safe. So never thought about it.
Was it hard for you to get used to life in the big city, moving from Trinidad to New York? Because, you know, New York's a big, scary town.
Yeah. Yes, it is. But the person I was a go-getter. You know, nothing could stand in my way. I thought, you know, I had the personality to get what I want. And I had that, you know, I had that really brave instinct in me that I can do it and I'm going to get it. I'm not scared. I was just a rebel, I would say, in getting what I want. So it wasn't really hard. I did odd jobs, but I just do what I had to do.
Tell me about your partner at the time. Who's now your husband?
Yes. Well, I met Roger back in Trinidad, actually, when I went back to a carnival festival in Trinidad in 2000. And he was there also at that festival because he was already living in the U.S. And we met, we exchanged numbers, and that was it. Then I came back to the U.S. and we started a relationship. And that was going pretty well. But then there's some things that he tried to change in me, my dressing attire, my partying, my drinking. And I'm like, no, that's not going to work for me. And we broke it up after a couple months. And we reunited prior to the World Trade Center happened.
Yeah, you got back together again, didn't you? So there must have been something that really there, though, after all that.
Yeah, he was a great guy. I mean, he wanted different things in life. He was more mature than me, and he wanted a family. He wanted to settle down. He wanted to marry. And he just, his life was fixed, and mine was, I was just finding my way and thinking that there's something more out there for me.
Now, normally he would have traveled to work with you on that day, wouldn't he, Janelle? But he went in early, though, that day.
When I moved in with him, you know, we were both working in the city at that time, and we would take the train together, we would ride the train together. And that particular morning, he didn't. He went late, early, and I was running late.
So there you are. It's a day like any other. September 11, 2001. You get up to the office, you go and get your bagel with cream cheese.
Yes.
Hot chocolate. The nutritious breakfast that everyone needs to start the workday.
Yes, I wasn't much into coffee at that time. You know, I had my hot chocolate, and I was just there sitting and setting up my computer and talking with my girlfriend.
What was it that made you stop? What was the first thing that let you know that something had happened?
When we was chit-chatting, and the building just shook. We heard a bang, and the building just trembled side to side.
Was it really loud, or was it really, really distant sounding?
It was a distant bang that we heard, and but the shake was, oh, it was horrible. The shake was like swayed so much and rumble.
Well, sorry, the whole tower swayed.
Yeah, the whole.
How much was it? How bad was that?
It swayed enough like to kind of move me from the seat I was sitting in a little bit. So, but the tremble that came with it, the tremble effect that came beneath it under my feet, just rumble like, you know, the walls. Like the floor was going to open. And I looked at her, and she looked at me, and I like opened my eyes. I'm like, what the hell is that? I'm like, what was that? It stopped. We got up and we walked towards the window because our cubicle was in the aisle. And we walked towards the window, and there we saw bits of papers all in the sky, just all over. And I said to myself, probably something got blown open on the higher floors, a window got blown open. And then at first when I felt the shake, though, I thought it was an earthquake, because back in Trinidad I had experienced an earthquake. So I just like, oh my God, it's an earthquake in New York, and you know, at first. But after I got up and we looked out there, and then I looked down to the glass, put my face really close to the glass, I saw a ball of fire like on the roadway, and I didn't understand what was going on.
So you could see on the ground,
yeah,
a fire of some kind.
Yeah, it's.
Could you see engine parts? I mean, you wouldn't have known what it was, would you?
No, it was, you know, 64-4 looking on down the people really small down on the roadway. It was just like a fire bit, like all over the floor, and I like, what happened? You know, what is that?
When I read your story, Janelle, I have to constantly try and knock out the hindsight that I have, because you know, I'm thinking, were you looking down and seeing an engine? Why on earth would you be expecting to see an aeroplane engine on the ground? You wouldn't, of course. So,
no.
So what had happened was very odd, in other words, and very mysterious.
Yeah. So when I saw that little blaze of fire, I couldn't make what it was. I couldn't make out what it was, but I knew it was red, orange looking fireball, like. And we left, and we just started going back and forth trying to figure out what was going on. And other coworkers were already leaving. People were just going through the exit later. And for some reason, I stayed back trying to figure out, because there was no song to leave. No alarm came on.
So there wasn't a panic in the office then, Janelle, at that point, at that time? There was no panic at all?
Not really. Not that I recall at that point. People were just leaving. I ran into my supervisor. He told me, I don't know, I think something happened. We got to leave. And I'm like, okay. You know, but I went look to find Rosa, and Susan was with me. And
these are your friends? Yeah.
These are my coworkers, because we all both started around the same time with the company. And we were all the three youngest in the company there. And Rosa was there. She was going back and forth. She was on the phone. And then I went to her and said, what happened? Do you know what happened? And she said, I think a plane hit the building. And that's when I thought, it got to be a small airplane, a Manhattan airplane, and just clipped the building accidentally and forth. And just back and forth, mixed messages, just going up and down the office space. And then we ran into one of the project manager. He was on the phone relaying the message to the police. They told us to stay put. And that's when.
Was there a kind of emergency protocol you'd been drilled in?
Exactly. When I started there in January of 2008, we went through the fire drill of, if in case of an emergency, the lights is going to go on, we don't use the elevator, we take the exit, the siren's going to go. We went through that sort of drill in case, if there is ever an emergency. And that never happened that day.
Alarms didn't go off.
Alarms didn't go off. And yeah, and that is part of what I was waiting for. Like, okay, the alarm, it's not, nothing is going off.
Was the power still on?
The power was still on. And after a while, the power went off in the other end of the building, other end of the floor.
So there's still quite a bit of confusion. What was your gut instinct at this point? You know, you'd seen people rushing to the exits, but you stayed, and a lot of other people stayed. What was your gut telling you at the time?
It was telling me something was wrong, but it wasn't like that magnitude, a big airliner. And after the project manager made that call, I called Roger, because he worked not too far from my office building.
Your boyfriend then, as
yeah,
it was.
My boyfriend.
And what did you say to Roger?
And I told him, I said, I think something happened and we may have to leave. And he told me, he said, well, I don't know. I guess he didn't see anything from where he was standing. And I said, he said, anyhow, just leave. If you think it's something really wrong, just leave. I said, okay, I'm going to leave. I'm going to meet, I'm going to wait for you outside of the Century 21 store. And he told me, fine, okay, I'll meet you there. And
so you thought at some point you'd just get into a lift, go down, and just meet him a couple of blocks away or something. And meet up with him. And what, an hour later or something, that was the plan, or even sooner?
Yeah, that was back then. And I never left when I told him I was going to be there. And that's when we decided to, people were just going back and forth, and we went into the conference room, put the TV on, and there it was.
You heard a scream, didn't you, from the TV room?
Yeah.
What did you see when you went into the TV room?
Oh my God. The TV was on. Some of the coworkers was in there. And there was a reporter on TV talking about other plane hit the other building and this could be a possibly terrorist attack. That was her exact word. And I'm like, oh my God, what are they talking about? What is a terrorist attack? Where I grew up, I never heard of it. And I'm like, what? In my mind, I'm like, I couldn't believe it. I thought it was a dream. I thought, no, this is not happening. And I think someone switched the TV off and we all, Pasquale, one of the project manager, he said, listen, you know, we've been here over an hour. It's past the hour and no one is coming to get us. Are we going to stay or go?
This was an hour after the first
plane
hit.
Definitely was.
You're still in your office on the 64th floor. I love the fact before you made the decision to leave, you went and saved your work on your computer. I mean, yeah. That's... You're a seriously good employee,
Janelle. Yeah. I mean, I was in a different frame of mind from other people, I guess, because I was thinking about my job. I just got this job, and I was just a temp worker working there. So I still got to do the right thing, you know, because I need to get paid. I need to get this job. And so I went back and took my computer off, grabbed my bag, put everything back in order. That's what I did. I don't know why I did it.
You are seriously diligent. You are. That's amazing. Yeah. Janelle Guzman-McMillan is my guest in conversation. Janelle was the last survivor to be pulled out of the wreckage of the World Trade Center after the terrorist attack in 2001. So you're all ready to leave at this point, but then someone from the Port Authority says, stay put,
mm-hmm.
Which I suppose, what effect did that have on everyone?
When I looked at people's faces when we got that information of stay put, somebody's going to get us, come to get us, some people was like calm and some people was like, okay, you know, this is crazy. But yet no one said, you know, let's just leave until Pasquale decided that we should leave. And within that time, I think he had an accent, a Russian worker. He was there. He's an engineer with the company. And he said, oh, no, the building is not going to fall. It's designed this way. It's not going to fall. And he said he's not leaving. He's going to wait. And at that point, I'm like, what is he talking about? I'm like,
Did you burst into tears? I mean, that would be very stressful then, Janelle.
Oh, yeah. Rosa started to cry. Then she made me cry. And Susan was just hugging us. And we were just dear for each other. But I was really scared at that point.
So your boss on the phone is saying stay. Mm-hmm. Your project manager in the building with you is saying we should go now. And then the Russian engineer is saying, no, you should stay.
Yes.
And meanwhile, there's an exploded passenger airliner who's mm-hmm. crashed into the building directly mm-hmm. above you. Was there smoke in the office at this time?
Oh, after a while being... We all got her on one side of the building now because at one point the lights went off on the other side. So we all were in one little area. Then there was smoke coming in on the other side of the building. Pasquale again, he told us, he said, okay, smoke is coming in the other side. We guys need to find anything possible, the jackets, whatever, coats, whatever is in any other cubicles, wet it in the kitchen sink and just block the doorway. And I remember doing that. I remember grabbing just any random jacket and Rosa was with me and we were wetting it in the kitchen sink and putting it towards the door. And then we ran back up and Pasquale was deciding, okay, I think this is crazy, we should go. And at that point, we left.
It was that like a moment of clarity? Suddenly, Pasquale, your supervisor, goes, we've got to get out of here. I mean,
because
as you're telling me, I'm thinking, get out. But I suppose that shows, it tells us so much about what people go through in a crisis like that.
Yes, Pasquale... I can see his face, the look on his face, a tall guy, big guy. And I think Pasquale, he was just newly married, and I think his wife was expecting a baby. So I can imagine how he had felt, you know, knowing. He was scared, but he was really trying to keep it together and be a leader for us. And when he decided, I'm leaving, you guys, are you with me? We all said yes, and that's when we decided to take the staircase.
Once you opened the staircase, what did you see?
Well, at first, Pasquale said he was going to check to see if the staircase is all cleared. He went out the door, checked the staircase, he came back up. He said, it's fine, it's all lit up, but if we can get any extra flashlight, we can, you know, that would be better. And it was cleared, it was all lit up, and we decided to go.
Now, you were dressed as the most fabulous office worker in the whole building.
that day.
Yes.
Tell me about your shoes.
Oh, my gosh. Those was a new pair of shoes because after I and Roger had reunited after our little breakup, he took me shopping that Sunday. And I had bought new shoes, new outfit, everything, you know. And, yeah, it was a beautiful new boots. I love boots. And it was like 4 inches. I think they had it wrong in the book. They said 2 inches, but I never wear 2 inches heel. I always go for three, four.
Three or four inches heels?
Yes, because I'm only 5'3", and I try to be really tall. Yeah, I like to look tall and, you know, fabulous. So
it's incredible the effect shoes can have on on clarity of thought in this incredible moment.
Yes.
So you go into the stairwell dressed like this, 4-inch heels.
Yes.
And what did you carry with you? Did you have your bag?
Yes, I most took my handbag. I think I had a little sweater with me as well. I threw that on, and Rosa was with me, and we were holding hands, and I was like, okay, we gotta go. So we start going down the staircase, and we started counting each staircase as we head down.
Now, just before you left there, the building swayed again. This is essentially swaying like a reed in the wind right now, the building, isn't it?
Yes. Before we actually head down to the staircase, and at that point, I think we were actually getting a head count of how many of us were actually in here. The building swayed. It shook again, and it swayed side to side. And there I looked at the Russian guy, and I was like, okay, do you think that the building is not going to fall now? In my mind, you know, I'm like, okay, this is crazy. And we just head out. And then while going down to the staircase, we felt a rumble, a little shake while going down. But we was going down, so that was all that mattered.
When you started to descend, how much time had passed since the first plane had hit? It was nearly an hour and a half, wasn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Isn't that amazing?
It was an hour and a half.
That you were up there all that time after the first plane hit.
Yeah, don't know why we stayed that long.
But that's what people do in a crisis where you can't at that moment get your head around the full enormity of what... I mean, watching at home, it was impossible to get your head around it at the same time.
I know.
So you go down, you're going down the stairs, and it's interesting the Russian guy's there with you too, but this point he's made it, it's time to go now.
Yes.
So... what was it like going down the stairwell? Was there much smoke in the stairwell as you went down?
No, the stairwells was pretty all lit up, and it's very wide, big staircase. And I and Rosa were holding hand, and everybody else were behind us. Pasquale was in front, leading the way, and he would make a couple of staircase down, and he would shout out and say, "Is everybody okay? Is everybody okay?"
So there's no panic, no panic.
No panic in a moderate pace, not running scarily. You know, we just. Walking fast enough. And I and Rosa turned and we would ask, you know, the rest of the crew behind us, is everybody okay? Are you okay? And they would say, yeah, just keep going. We're fine.
But how genuinely frightened were you, Janelle?
Oh my God, I was too frightened to explain. I was shaking at one point, but Rosa was there with me and I tried to like kind of, you know, suck it all up and be strong for her.
For each other.
Yeah. So, but, you know, we was just reassuring, okay, we're going, we're doing fine, we're almost there.
So you go down and down and down from the 64th floor, and you hit the 50th floor, then you keep going down. Mm-hmm. And then you ran into some firemen in the stairwell. What were they doing?
One of the firemen was sitting with his gears. One was coming up, and he looked at us. He said, you're doing great, just be careful going down, stay at the side, be careful. And the other one offered us, he asked if we wanted water. And we said no. And then when I saw those firemen coming up and we going down, my heart felt different. I'm like, okay, we're going to make it out. They're coming up, we're going down, it should be okay. It's got to be okay. And then we just continue going down.
And then you reach the 13th floor at... lucky or unlucky number. And what happened on the 13th floor, Janelle?
When we were going down and we made it to the 13th staircase, Rose, I told Rose, I mean, she'd been telling me going all along, take your shoes off. Why don't you take those shoes off? I'm like, no, I can't. I don't want to take my shoes off. I don't want to stop. I'll be fine. And when I made it to the 13th staircase, it's now my legs, my feet were killing me. And I said, Rose, I need to stop to take my shoes off. And I was laughing with her, and she was laughing. And then I stopped. I bent over, and I reached for my left foot to take my shoes off. And before I could stand back up in a standing position, everything, the dust, the walls caved in, the rumbling, everything was just come crashing down. I remember Rosa just pulling away and running back up the staircase. I tried to go behind her, and something hit me back on the floor, and I was just, boom, I just landed on the floor with my head down.
Listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler.
Janelle Guzman-McMillan is my guest today in Conversation. Janelle was working in the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001, and the first plane hit the building she worked in, some floors above her. Despite her best attempts to get out, she was caught on the 13th floor and survived a 27-hour ordeal to become the last survivor pulled from the wreckage of the Twin Towers. Janelle, you were just saying before that the walls seemed to come in or the roof came in because everything's crumbling around you, but then you're still 13 floors above ground, aren't you?
Yes, and, a lot of people ask, when it happened, when the building collapsed, was I, tumbling down in the rubble going? It wasn't like that. Before I could even straighten myself back up, when I tried to take my shoes off, the walls, to me, like it just caved in like a explosion. It's like a bomb just was in the wall and everything was just crumbling, the dust, the darkness. It knocked me down and I kept right there on that floor and everything was coming on top of me. The dust, it was just burying me at one point. And then I just stood there until it came to a complete stop. It's nothing I could have done. I thought, oh my God, I'm dreaming. This has to be a dream. I can't believe this just happened.
Did you pass out at any stage? You were awake, you were alert the whole...
No, I never passed out. I knew exactly what was happening, but I just thought it was a dream.
It's a miracle you weren't killed in the explosion and the fall from 13 floors above ground.
Yeah, when it all came down, crashing down, and I knew when I landed to the floor, I knew when somehow I put my hands over my head and I blocked my face most of all. I just wait there and in my mind, this is a dream. I'm going to wake up from this bad dream. But when I realized that I shut my eyes briefly when it came to a complete stop. And when I opened my eyes, I realized that, oh my gosh, my head is stuck. My body is completely stuck and I couldn't move. And that's when I realized it wasn't a dream. This was really happening.
Could you move your head?
My head was pinned between two concrete pillars, pressing on my earlobe, on my face, and I had my left hand loose, but I tried to feel the distance of where my head was stuck between the concrete. It was like really close to the, felt like walls all around me. My head couldn't get to touch my ear or my face at the side because the two concrete pillars, I really don't know how I ended up in that position.
Could you see anything?
Nothing, completely dark. And the dust was in my mouth and my nose and couldn't see nothing as much as I tried.
You couldn't see your hand in front of your face?
I couldn't see my hand. I knew I had my watch on still. I felt my watch dangling on my left hand. But at that time, my watch didn't have those light up, face. I couldn't see anything.
Where were your friends? Could you see them? Could you or hear them? Or were they any sense of them?
At that point, when I knew I was under there and it was happening and it was so silent, I waited to hear if Rosa would call out. And then within that silence, I heard a voice call out for help three times, but it was a man's voice. And in my mind, all I can think who that voice had called out was the Russian man behind me, because he was behind me while we were coming down the staircase. And I heard nothing after that. It was just silence.
What hurt the most? What was the most painful part of this?
The most painful part was my head being wedged between the concrete pillar. It felt like it was going to explode. And my legs in that crisscross position, that at one point I didn't feel my leg. I couldn't, so I just ignored that. But my head, trying to move it, trying to just push it forward or backward, there was nothing I can do.
What could you hear?
At one point, I did hear the I heard the radio going off. I heard
like a normal,
like a radio,
transistor radio. Something,
yeah,
like a
Motorola. You know, trying, you know, at that point, there was those Motorola phones that people walkie-talkie stuff, and I could hear the like a reverse song of a truck making, you know, you put your car in reverse and it has that beep beep sound. I heard that, and then after one point I didn't hear anything.
And you smelt you described the smell of, it was like water on concrete or something.
Yeah,
it?
it was really wet smell of rock, and yeah, it was a really weird, smelly, foully smell. And at one point I was feeling so cold. I started to shiver, my teeth started to shatter. And then one point again it got so hot. And I thought, oh my God, the building probably on fire. Probably there is a fire somewhere. It was that hot. And I just stood there.
What could you move? You could move one hand, and that was it?
My left hand, that was it.
And how far could you push ahead in front of you?
At least, when I decided to, you know, use my left hand, I was feeling around me. My stomach, I can feel my stomach, but I can feel the concrete sticking me in my stomach. I move at the side of my leg backwards, and I felt something soft. And I somehow, I just thought, it could be, it's soft, it's probably a body. And I left my hands up in the air, and I could feel it like it's in the open space. So I kind of stretch it all the way, my left hand eventually stretched all the way up. But when I felt that softness, I wasn't scared, but I knew somehow it felt like a body, because I was just like feeling around it and feeling and squeezing it. And after, I knew it was a body after my rescue.
It was a fireman, wasn't it?
It was a fireman. Didn't know how he got there or how I got next to the body, but that's the body was beneath me.
You were supposed to, of course, you'd arranged to meet Roger, and yeah, you weren't going to be there for that appointment. What did you find out Roger was doing at this time? He must have seen the building go down.
Yeah, Roger was outside waiting for me to come out. As he tells me his story, people were coming out, running, rushing, and he would ask everyone, what floor did you come from? What floor did you come from? And people were coming from higher floors than me, more than the 64th. And at that point, he couldn't do nothing, but when he saw the building come down, he just had to run. And I knew Roger was a mess after that, from what I, you know, interviewed him. He thought I was dead.
And your daughter Kimberly in Trinidad, how was she told?
Kimberly was told by her dad. Well, he's in Trinidad as well. And she was told, I think, after she was picked up from school. And her father was telling her about what had happened in New York. And he just broke down and he told her that your mom is in there and she's nowhere to be found yet. And that's how she was told. And she was, she just went into her room, as she recalled to me, and locked herself and prayed that it wasn't happening, that I wasn't dead.
Your mouth was like full of dust and plaster and, yeah, and concrete dust. And mm-hmm. Could you cry out? Were you able to cry out?
I did call out for help, you know, one time or two times, but I didn't want it to move. I was scared. I was really scared. I didn't want it to even try to move anymore, because I was scared that the building would collapse even more. You know, I thought I was on the edge of somewhere. I had no idea where I was. But I was always more reserved person also, and I just didn't cry it out loud enough. I couldn't.
How was you had a watch on, but you couldn't see the time, obviously, could you?
No.
So what was your sense of time passing then, hour after hour? Was it odd?
It, it felt, at the time, felt like it was forever. At that point, when I tried to look at my watch, you know, it felt forever. And I think I felt the sense of it was darkness probably when it got cold. I thought probably that should be darkness then, when it started to get really cold. So, but
it was the strangeness of it led you to another thought, which was that you'd actually died.
Yeah, yeah.
The thought you were in hell at one point.
Of course, I was like, I feel like if I've been to hell and back, and, you know, of me being there, you know, in disbelief of what actually happened, and this pain and agony, I was like, oh my God, is this what hell is all about? I don't want to go there. And at that point, I just knew something I had to do because I was still breathing, I was still alive.
You started to pray then. What were you praying with for to start with?
I began to pray, not like the Our Father prayer that I was taught or the Lord is my shepherd prayer that my mom taught me. I just started to think about everything, my daughter, my mom, Roger, and I just started to beg. It wasn't really a prayer. It was really begging and pleading with God that I want to live and I want a second chance and I want to be with my daughter and I want to change. And I just begged from deep within my heart, knowing that I wanted to change.
You made a deal.
Definitely.
What was the deal?
I made a deal and begging with God that, Lord, if you save me today, if you spare my life, I promise I would do your will. I would change. I would be a better person. I would be whatever you want me to be. And I made that promise to God that I would live a life according to his will.
Janelle Guzman McMillan is here. She's written a book called Angel in the Rubble, How I Survived for 27 Hours Under the World Trade Center Debris. As you say, it got hot and then incredibly hot like an oven, then it got incredibly cold. And I suppose it was hard to tell whether that was the environment or your own body temperature because you're in trauma. And yeah. Were you passing in and out of consciousness?
No, not in and out of consciousness.
Sleeping?
I decided to take a nap. I decided to just go to sleep. It's nothing else to do but pray for a miracle and hope to be found. And, you know that you're alive, so, and you can't move. What else can you do? But I wasn't unconscious and hallucinating. I knew exactly what was happening around me, and I knew the time was just going longer and longer.
I think you said you were able to eventually then after push your hand through a hole or thereabouts in the blackness in front of you.
Yes, at that point, which, like, after hours, of course, the pain was just, my head was feeling like it was going to explode. And I was like, oh, my God, I can't take this no more. And, you know, I was just begging and praying, God, could you show me a sign, you know, show me a miracle or something. I can't do this. I want to live. And for some reason, I took my left hand up and I put it up in the open. I felt the concrete above me. Felt like part concrete, part wood. So I think it was part of the staircase that fell over me as well. And I put my hand in the open thinking that somebody would see it. And I just kept it out there. And I said, oh, God, please, please show me a sign. And at that point, within that prayer, someone grabbed my hand and called me by my name and told me his name is Paul. And when he grabbed my hand, I felt totally calm in my body. But the name, when he said his name, it just like registered in my head because I'm like, oh my God, Paul is holding my hand. I am alive. I'm going to get out. I'm going to be fine. And he kept reassuring me that I'm going to hold your hand. I'm not going to let you go. Someone is going to come. Just hold on to my hand. And he kept reassuring me. And I felt totally calm. And I just said to myself, thank God.
How long was he there with you, holding your hand, telling you everything? I suppose it's hard to ask you that because you don't know what the time is, but how did it feel like?
Yeah, Paul was definitely there at least over 10 minutes or so. Paul was still holding my hand, and he was just holding my hand. And it's like my weight, I just dropped my weight in his hand, but he wouldn't let me let go of my hand. He was just holding it up there, but I know my hand was just dead weight holding onto his. And I kept squeezing his hand, and, you know, it felt like he was there for a long time, but he with the reassuring of they're almost here, you know, until I heard actually the other rescuer talking and maneuvering through the rubble, and then they call out to me. That's when I knew I started to talk with the other rescuer.
Who were these rescuers?
From what I understand and who I met, who was part of the rescue was Rick and Brian. They actually found me by, I think, the sense of one of the dog tracker who was there. And they noticed the fireman's jacket, what was reflecting, that led them to actually come on top of that rubble to find me. Because I was buried like 30-something feet under. And they were shining a light. And I couldn't see the light. I asked them, when they were shining the light and calling out my name, I was like, I don't see the light. Do you see my hand? And Paul was still holding my hand.
So what happened then? Paul's holding your hand. The rescuers are coming mm-hmm. for you. Mm-hmm. Is Paul a rescuer? Is he a rescuer?
He's my rescuer. You know, I never found Paul. And when I asked Brian and Eric about Paul and, you know, if they saw Paul holding my hand or which one of you was holding my hand, they was just as amazed as me. And they told me that I don't think anyone on the team, on the rescue team who was there was ever... There was no name Paul.
So once they prized you free then, once they got you out of the rubble mm-hmm. and got your poor head.
Yeah.
What was Paul holding your hand at that time?
Oh no, when Paul let go of my hand exactly when they removed the rubble, the concrete that was over my head. And one of the guy, I think, pulled me by my hand, my shoulder, and Paul let go of my hand and said, okay, you know, they got you. And he let go, and the other guys were trying to, you know, strap me in and everything. So I don't know at what point that Paul saw them or what went on. I don't know, but all I know, you know.
And when your head was free, did you see Paul then?
No. I tried. When my head was break loose and relaxed, I tried to open my eyes, but my eyes were blurry. I couldn't see anything. All I could just hear the voices of one of the rescuers told me, oh, my God, you're lucky, you know, stuff like that. And, you know, they were just talking with me. And I said to them, I said, oh, my God, am I going home? And I think I was laughing with them. As they said, they told me I was smiling. And I said, am I going home? And he turned to me. He said, no, we're taking you to the hospital.
There you are. You're one seriously bashed up girl. And you've got a big smile on your
yes,
face.
Yes, I did.
What was it like to go out into sunlight?
Oh, my gosh. That was a moment. While they were bringing me out of that, wherever it was, it felt like I was in hills and valleys. They were going up and down with me in a long process walking me out. And when I got out and the hot sunlight hit my face, I knew I was in the open. I tried to open my eyes. It was blurry, and I could hear the people around me. Everybody was clapping and cheering on and saying, oh, God, we found one, and, you know, she's alive. And everybody was just saying stuff, and I was smiling. I knew I was smiling. And I told one of the paramedic who was there, I think he put something in my throat. And, you know, he made me gag a lot because I think he tried to remove the dust in my throat or whatever. And I told him, I said, am I going home? And he said, no, it'll be a long time before you go home. We're taking you to the hospital. And I told him, but I think I'm fine. But I couldn't feel my right leg at that point. So I just thought it was asleep.
And once you're out, then the building
that's what I heard.
Collapsed.
As long as they when they pulled me out, that's when the building collapsed completely.
Poor Roger. When was he told you'd been found? How was he told?
Well,
because he was asked to come to the hospital, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was asked to come to the hospital. When I got to the hospital, I mean, I give them the correct information. They asked me what's the contact and everything. I was smiling. I was talking with them, telling them Roger's phone number, and they called him up. It took a couple hours before he got there, probably evening time already. And when he got to the hospital, I was lying there, ready to be prepped for surgery. And he came close to me, walked up to me, and close to my face because he couldn't recognize me. My head like was blown up 3 times the size, and my eyes were purple. And I'm thinking I'm looking just a little dusty, you know. I think I'm just looking dusty, you know. I didn't have any idea my head was that size and my eyes were purple and blue and all colors. And he looked at me so close in my face and he said, why didn't you get out when I told you to? And I just...
Yeah, that's a really good I told you so moment, isn't it? I mean, yeah, it's a perfect moment for that, isn't it?
Yeah. And I just smiled and I cried and I said, I don't know. And that was the moment. He just hugged and did with me and went to surgery.
Yeah, you said you weren't able to feel your leg. In fact, it had been completely crushed, hadn't it, Janelle?
Yeah.
What did they tell you about your leg?
My leg was completely crushed. It was totally dead. And I had 4 surgeries done on my right leg. And on the 3rd surgery, they wanted to amputate my leg because it was totally no good. I'm losing a lot of blood and tissues and whatever, and it was useless. And thank God, they tried on the 4th surgery and they saved my leg. And I didn't have to.
Yeah, you walked in here just fine today.
Yes.
A decade later.
I mean, I physically have a permanent limp because of all the surgery, and my nerves are completely dead in my right leg, but I don't be bothered with it. I just grateful.
So once you were out and you recovered, did you get depression and health issues after that?
No. Unfortunately, no. I never had to go through psychiatric watch, I should say. I never had to go through that depression or anxiety attack. I was totally healed from that moment.
As you see that as quite a religious moment for you, don't you? That process. Tell me a bit about that.
I think being under the rubble, spending 27 hours under there, it's like I've been to hell and back to me. And I had totally given my life to Jesus Christ that day under the rubble. My faith was renewed. You know, it was a new me, and I was willing to make the changes that I promised genuinely. And when I got to the hospital and I started reading my Bible, and my brother-in-law, who's a Christian, and, you know, he started telling me stuff of why you think you survive and why this happened. It just, you know, my faith was just getting stronger and stronger, and I knew if God pulled me through that ordeal, I think it's got to be a bigger plan and a purpose for me here. And I believe in that, and my faith just started developing, and I realized that this is a life that I want to live.
I mean, you're just a normal person going to work on that day, and Osama bin Laden and his associates, you know, ordered the attack on the World Trade Center and nearly killed you and killed many of your friends, because your friends weren't found, were they,
mm-hmm.
Janelle?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about him now and his people?
Well, you know, it's so sad that people would have that frame of hatred in their mind and, you know, want to do that, kill so many people and then kill themselves in the process. But, you know, what happened to him, as now as I'm in a different place and, you know, I know God and I know that there is a God somewhat, I know God is going to handle it, and he's gone, and it brought a lot of closure to a lot of family, but we can't bring back the family that they lost.
Is it possible to forgiveness? I mean, your religion asks a lot of you in that sense, isn't it, to forgive people like him?
Yeah, well, Richard, you know, back then I would probably go hunt him for myself if I wasn't a different, you know, if I was totally the same Janelle. I was like, oh, you mess up my leg, you kill my, you know, but it was like a revival for me, and I don't know what happened, you know, what take control of me that just give me that peace, then say, you know what, God's going to take care of it. And that's all I can hope and pray on. And, you know, it just make me a better person.
I mean, I suppose in some ways that religious feeling is a reflection of ourselves insofar as the one that you got, which gave you the kind of grace to get through that, mm-hmm. and help you through it, is kind of the same kind of feeling that would direct a man like that to mm-hmm. get people to board a plane and fly them into the towers. What do you mm-hmm. think of that?
You know, that is unheard of to me. And for somebody to do that, you know, take a plane and drive into the towers and kill so many people, it's like you wonder a lot of, you know, what people beliefs are. And, you know, but in retrospect of that, I'm forever grateful, and I wish it never had to happen, and I wouldn't wish it upon anybody else. And that's why part of this book that I write is just to let people know how I overcome that tragedy and, you know, and how much prayer had to do with me being here today and the faith that I have grown so much to know. And, you know, I don't want people to fear of, you know, their life, thinking that, you know, faith have to overcome fear in some aspect in my life. And for people to live their life thinking that, oh, it's going to happen again. Fear, that's an option for me. And I choose faith over fear. And I just hope and pray that this country could change and be a better place and it never have to happen again in history.
There was such joy around your survival, because I think news networks had been going to air saying, we don't expect to find any more survivors. And there you were. And your survival made people really happy, actually. It was one of those few bits of solace they could get from that occasion. Insofar as people rushed to your aid when you and Roger decided to get married. And you had kind of a glam, seriously glam wedding, didn't you?
Afterwards? Yeah. It's like, there are good people out there. And I mean, for them to do that just because, you know, I survived the World Trade Center, that's amazing to me. I didn't expect anything like that. I was just looking at myself as, oh, I'm just the little Janelle from the island of Trinidad. I survived a horrific day, and I thank God, and I changed my life. But for people to be so outgoing towards me and offer me all these things, I'm like, oh, my God. There really is a God out there, and people are just so amazing and could be, you know, so beautiful towards you. And I appreciated that, you know, it was a beautiful wedding, and, you know, it's something that I never expected. I mean, it was part of my dream growing up to have a beautiful wedding, but I think everything happened in such a positive way for me, and I thank God for that.
Is Kimberly with you now?
Yes, Kimberly came with me the year after, and she's been with me ever since.
I can't tell you how glad I am to see you alive and well and sitting across from me. And I suppose you're used to people saying that to you as well. Janelle, it's so lovely to have you tell that remarkable story. I think it's great, granted all sorts of new insights there. Thank you so much for being my guest in conversation today.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Thank you for downloading this podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.